This week's episode of A Cast of Kings is brought to you by Hover. Hover is the best way to buy and manage domain names. When you have a great idea, you want to secure a great domain name for it. You want something catchy and memorable to represent your project. Hover gives you exactly what you need to find the perfect domain for your idea. This week, to get 10% off your first order at Hover, go to hover.com/egg. That's hover.com/egg. Now, Joanna, I confess I'm a little bit confused as to why this week's promo code is egg. Can you explain this?
This is an especially nerdy book reference, but Egg is the nickname, actually, of Aegon Targaryen, who was brother to Master Aemon Targaryen, who, as you all know, spoke the line in this episode, "Kill the boy," which gave the episode its title. The way that speech goes in the book, it's a little longer, but he's talking about his brother Aegon, and he says, "A man grown with sons of his own, yet in some ways he was still a boy. Egg had an innocence to him, a sweetness we all loved. Kill the boy within you, I told him the day I took the ship for the wall. It takes a man to rule. An Aegon, not an egg. Kill the boy and let the man be born."
All right. Well, there you go. And if you want to get 10% off your first domain order at hover.com, just go to hover.com/egg and you'll be paying homage to the Targaryen family as well. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
I'm Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. If you're just tuning in to this podcast for the first time, you can find more of our episodes at GameofThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us or find us on Twitter and Facebook at A Cast of Kings. That's acastofkings@gmail.com, twitter.com/acastofkings, and facebook.com/acastofkings. What we're going to do this week is we are going to spoil everything through this week's episode of Game of Thrones. That's Season 5, Episode 5, Kill the Boy. But we will not spoil anything from future week's episodes, and that includes anything on the next time on preview that HBO likes to show at the end of each episode. That's what we do on the podcast. We just talk about every episode in depth. Before we get into this week's episode, Season 5, Episode 5, Kill the Boy, we've got to make a few announcements. Firstly, we're recording this podcast very late on a Monday night, and so as a result, in order to get this out sooner, there will probably be no clips in this episode. I usually like to put some clips in the episode, and I really like, you know, that we can talk about something and then you can hear what we're talking about right after that, but not for this week's episode, unfortunately, because I know people prefer us to get the episodes out sooner rather than later with clips. So sorry about the no clips this week. They shall return in future weeks. We've been getting a lot of questions about old episodes of the podcast. If you go to GameofThronesPodcast.com, you can find all the old episodes. They're not going to be in the iTunes feed, but they will be there, so you can download them individually and get those files at GameofThronesPodcast.com. Just page backwards until you find the episodes that you're looking for. Speaking of iTunes, if you listen to this show and enjoy it, we'd greatly appreciate it if you could head over to iTunes and leave us a star rating or a review. It would be greatly appreciated, especially if you're a fan of the podcast. And finally, we got to mention some stuff that we left out of the podcast last week, right? Season 5, Episode 4. Joanna, I believe you wanted to mention a few items, yes?
Yeah, I definitely want to give a shout out to Mace Tyrell and the Small Council scene. This is the second time we've forgotten to talk about the Small Council, but we should know that Cersei has sent Mace Tyrell away from King's Landing, and she sent Meryn Trant with him, and apparently they're going to Braavos. So
right, and usually when Meryn Trant goes places with people, they don't end up in a good situation. If I recall correctly, is that correct?
Dun, dun, dun. I mean, he is the number one henchman for Cersei Lannister at the moment, so
my assumption was that he is done for, like, when I saw that scene.
Do you think that's the last we'll ever see of Mace Tyrell?
It's possible, at least in one piece. That's kind of my assumption about Mace Tyrell, which made me feel really sad, because he is a hapless character. He is completely devoid of hap.
so delightful. And I feel like they didn't even bother with King's Landing this week because they're like, why bother going to King's Landing if Mace Tyrell isn't there to drop some amazing gems of comedy gold?
I'm sure that was the rationale, Jenna. So also, there's a few things we didn't mention last week, or at least I don't think we discussed them in depth. Firstly, in their almost love scene between Melisandre and Jon Snow, she chimes in with, "You know nothing, Jon Snow," at the end of it. And it's kind of an enigmatic way of saying it, because, I mean, at that point, Jon Snow had just rejected her sexual advancements. What were your thoughts on that, like, why she said it that way? Or was it just – was there any broader purpose to that other than just, like – was it just a coincidence that she said the exact same thing as Ygritte, or was there something more to it, or can you not say?
No, I don't know, and I don't want to ascribe powers to Melisandre that she does not possess, but that seemed like some witchy voodoo crap to me. Right. for him to turn her down and evoke Ygritte's name, basically, and then for her to drop Ygritte's signature line. Was if that was something that she sort of dredged up from the ether because of her witchy ways, that's cold, right?
Yeah, that is mean. Not cool, man.
It's mean.
Not cool. Also, when Sansa was in Winterfell last week, and also this week, we heard the line spoken, "The North remembers."
Yeah.
And we learned a little bit more about that this week, and like what that purpose was. But I guess that is a saying that's been said. I don't know if it's been said in the series multiple times, but I definitely read it in association with the show, like in the promotional materials and so on. I was wondering if you could explicate that a little bit. I mean, I'm pretty sure I understand what it's saying, but I wonder if there's anything there that I'm missing.
Well, what do you – okay.
I'll tell you what my thoughts are on it, which are that the idea is that the North has a long institutional memory. I think that's what they're trying to say, although that doesn't roll us trippingly off the tongue. They're saying that like all the people there remember what injustices have been perpetrated against them, specifically the murder of the Starks.
Yeah. So the reason it might ring a bell to you is it's actually the name of one of the episodes. Season 2, Episode 1 is called The North Remembers.
Nice.
But yeah, in the book specifically, it crops up. You know, it might be an old phrase that it crops up specifically around the Red Wedding. And just to say that, like, basically it means even though the Boltons are in Winterfell, the small folk of the North remember what happened to the Starks.
Right.
So it's sort of a rallying cry. But I believe in this episode, Ramsay's the one who says it, which is – that's like Melisandre saying, you know nothing, Jon Snow. Like, he has no right to say the North remembers.
Right,
so,
right. Exactly. Yeah. All right. So I think that's all – oh, wait. No. We got one more thing we got to mention. So, so throughout this podcast, there has been a raging debate about the value of the Ollie character.
Right. Yeah.
Of course, I'm on Team Ollie.
Right. And I'm on Team Murder Ollie soon, please.
you're Team Kill Ollie. Although you wrote a very nice article about the person that plays Ollie this week at Vanity Fair, right?
Oh, I did. He has a lovely singing voice, that young man.
That is one of his many talents. Surin De Silva writes in, I know this is a bit late, but I found this quote from Benioff and Weiss from an interview they did for Variety in 2004 about writer Dave Hill.
2014. Sorry.
2014, yeah. About Dave Hill, to be interesting. "We had an assistant named Dave Hill," said Benioff and Weiss, "and one day last summer, he walked into our office and said, 'You know that kid Ollie whose family gets massacred by the wildlings? The one who runs to Castle Black to let them know the wildlings are nearby?' 'Yeah.' 'Well,' said Dave, 'doesn't it make sense that he'd stay at Castle Black and become a Night's Watch recruit? Where else is he going to go?' 'You're right,' we said. 'That does make sense. And what if during the battle for Castle Black, he's the one who ends up killing Ygritte?' This year, Dave Hill is a writer on the show." Surin De Silva continues, "I'm a book reader, so obviously I despise Ollie." Let me just pause right there. Is that really that obvious? I mean, come on. He's a poor little kid whose family got completely slaughtered mercilessly.
He killed Ygritte.
Yeah, but after she murdered his family, dude.
All right.
Anyway, I figured Dave Super Ollie fan Chen would love this. Maybe now he can add a picture of Dave Hill to the front of his binder, because without Dave Hill, Ollie would not be where he is today. poised to take the Iron Throne.
Is Dave Hill your pen name? Like, are you actually Dave Hill, Dave Chen?
Yeah. I mean, Hill is my pseudonym under which I write. So. Right. Anyway, so that's Ciaran de Silva writing into castofkings@gmail.com explaining how Ollie got his backstory. Basically,
Ollie's origin story, yeah.
An assistant wandered into the office.
And uninvited, now that assistant is a writer.
Uninvited and spewed out a bunch of nonsense about Ollie. No, I'm just joking. I'm obviously a fan of Ollie. I see a lot of myself in Ollie. Let's put it that way.
Oh, yeah. Now I feel the need to go a little easier on Ollie.
Good. Well, he certainly gets a great moment in this episode, Jonna. So, anyway, let's begin. Firstly, before we begin, one thing that's really interesting about this episode is I haven't been keeping close track, but this is probably one of the episodes that had the fewest plot lines referenced, like in the whole that I can recall. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I guess one of the reasons for that is because three of the plot lines have intersected.
Right.
Right. So, you know, in Winterfell, you got the whole Sansa, Ramsay, Theon, Brienne, and Pod. They're all in like this one place.
Right.
So by visiting this one place, we get like access to more plot lines than usual. But it did feel as though there were many plot lines left out this week. And I really like the pacing. This episode is written by Brian Cogman, friend of the show. And I thought like spending a lot of time, you know, I think we've been pushing for this too, like spending more time in fewer locations is more effective than spending a tiny bit of time in a lot of locations.
I think it's really rare for them to skip King's Landing. I mean, right. I have to go back and look, but usually we at least check in with King's Landing. So that was interesting this week.
Right. And there was also no Arya, right?
And no Dorne.
No Dorne. No Littlefinger action.
Right, because he's on the road.
Yeah. Anything else that there wasn't of this week?
I think that's all I can think of. Yeah. I mean, we still haven't seen Bran and Rickon in a million years, but we'll keep waiting until next season, probably.
That was okay. I will say that was quite a head fake from the previously on this week that they showed the whole like Bran and Rickon storyline in the previously on. So, you're watching the episodes live now? Are you not?
I am. Yeah.
So did you see the previously on?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. So they show basically like everything that happened to Bran and Rickon. Except the last scene that we see Bran in, where, you know, the whole, I don't even know how to describe what happens there, but I did think that like, oh my gosh, we're going to see Bran and Rickon this week. But in fact, it was a head fake.
They were just
showing, they were just showing that. So you remembered what Theon did or claimed to have done. So,
yeah. And I will admit, I mean, maybe I should wait till we get there, but I will admit that I had a very irrational thought later in the episode when Sansa's walking into that kennel. I was like, is she going to see the charred bodies of some boys? But it's been a really long time. That's definitely like what I thought before my brain caught up and was like, no, you dummy, it's Theon. So,
all right, so let's talk about a couple. Let's talk about Meereen first.
Okay.
I don't recall if at the end of last week's episode we went over like the ambiguity of the ending and who's dead and who's alive. I think we did, right? We mentioned that it's like fairly ambiguous. And this week we learn what exactly happened. Ser Barristan died, and Grey Worm survived. Now, is Grey Worm a character in the book, Joanna?
Yeah, but a much smaller character.
Gotcha. And here he has the romance with Missandei, and so,
right.
Did he die in the book at this point?
No.
Okay. But does he also have the relationship with Missandei in the book?
Missandei's a child in the book. No.
I see. Well, that doesn't answer the question, but yes.
Yeah. They've expanded both of their roles in a major way, I think, to try to make Dany's plot more interesting.
Right.
But I don't know that it's working. I mean,
yeah.
This might be a controversial opinion, but I don't care at all about Missandei and Grey Worm. And, you know, and that's no knock on the actors. Missandei was great in a Fast and Furious movie this year, but I just don't feel like they've done a great job with those characters, and I don't care. So
yeah, I completely agree. And the episode takes great pains this week to try and involve Missandei.
Right. And make us care. Well, I actually like Missandei and Dany's scene, but Missandei and Grey Worm, I'm not interested.
Yeah, I think there's just not enough there. Like, it's getting by purely on the charisma of the actors.
Right.
And, like, there's, you know, from a script perspective, I don't think there's enough there to make you feel like, oh, yeah, they do love each other. You know what I mean? Like, when you think of all the successful love stories in Game of Thrones, Jaime and Cersei and Jaime and Brienne even...
Yes.
Right. There's a lot that's going on there. There's a lot that's on screen. You see them interact on many, many occasions, and they have. Oh, by the way, speaking of which, we didn't see any Jaime this week.
Right. Well, he's included in the Dorne.
Oh, he's included in Dorne. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, you see a lot of what's going on with that interaction. Even Rob and Talisa, which is a plot line that I wasn't a huge fan of.
No.
They at least like did a lot to build that up. Right. I can respect what they were trying to do there, but
yeah.
With Grey Worm and Miss Sunday, just not quite enough not there, yeah,
no.
For me. Yeah. So I kind of agree with you there.
Yeah. I have to say, like, honestly, I wish Grey Worm had died and Barristan had lived. I'm sorry.
That is harsh.
And Barristan's not even that interesting in the show, but at least he's more interesting in the book, so there was a potential for something. And he had great old stories about Rhaegar and all this sort of stuff. So. I'll miss
Harrison. Harsh, yeah. I will miss him as well. And he had that badass moment when he showed up, I think, in season two.
Yeah, season two.
He re-enters Dany's life.
Yeah.
So that was very cool. Anyway, so Dany's super pissed.
I will say I kind of felt like Dany was speaking for me and all the people like me when she was like, Barristan the Bold, they called him. He was this great knight, and he was killed by a bunch of randos on the street.
Yep.
Which is how I felt last week, because that's not how Barristan should have gone down. But yeah, Dany's pissed, as you say.
She's super pissed, and she rounds up the heads of prominent families.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the rationale behind doing that, Joanna?
Well, the rationale being that the slave owners, which would be the heads of the prominent families, are clearly the ones behind the Sons of the Harpy. Not all of them necessarily, but that's where this is coming from, right? Is the slave owners who resent Dany's slave freeing ways are operating in a guerrilla warfare type, taking her out little by little. And so she's hoping to send a message by saying, you know, you kill my Barristan, I'm going to kill one of your most prominent citizens. I don't think it was a good plan, honestly. And and it's pretty funny because Barristan just last week was talking about how her father, the Mad King Aerys, used to burn people, right? And
it's almost as though Dany doesn't learn from her mistakes.
Almost. And she's like, you know what I take away from that, Barristan? I'm going to burn some people. Oh, they called him the Mad King Aerys, did they? Well, that's a great nickname.
Yeah, and it's also like Tyrion is probably betting his – or, you know, was going to bet his life on finding Dany. Like, this is the ruler they want, you know? Yeah, good luck with that plan, guy. I don't know how well, you know, her ruling is going. And she's made a lot of mistakes in the last couple seasons. So we'll see how it all turns out. So Missandei has a scene with Dany, right,
yeah.
on that note. And I thought it was kind of hilarious because Dany says, well, what do you think I should do? And Missandei says exactly what I was thinking, which is, well, I don't think I am qualified enough to have an opinion. And that is not meant to be a misogynist comment. That is just like – she is like the translator person. Like she you know, she doesn't have any expertise in any of what's going on, right?
Right.
Did that come off as misogynist? It didn't mean
no.
to be. It was just like you're –
No, I don't think it was sexist. It might have been a little classist. Like what is the – what is the low-born
what is this
translator?
Peasant girl? What does she think she can solve affairs of state? I'm okay with being classist. That's fine.
Okay.
But yeah, like I guess that it just felt like, oh, the show, like, okay, beyond my incredibly elitist ways, it's I guess it felt like the show was trying to like fit a square peg into a round hole, meaning like fit Missandei into this plotline to make us care about her more in a way that felt unnatural to me.
Maybe, or more just to show that Dany does not know what she's doing.
Yeah,
she's casting around for help from anyone.
It's just like anyone. The translator will help. Like
yeah.
Even that person is. I'm going to take anyone's advice at this point.
Yeah.
So.
And Masende's advice is like, do what you want to do.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't even like she had something incredibly valuable to share. Do you know what I mean? That's what I thought was so...
Well, I mean, the value that she instilled in Danny, whether or not it was misguided, the value she instilled was one of confidence. Like, you don't need to ask my advice or anyone's advice. You don't need Barristan. You know what to do. Do what you feel is right. Now we're sitting in the audience going like, Danny doesn't have a great track record with that. You know, Masende said this thing where
hasn't she been doing that the entire time is what, you know?
Masende said this thing where she's like, you know, sometimes you just don't listen to your advisors and you do what you feel is right and it's better. And I'm like, cite your sources, Masende.
like, what is she talking about?
Maybe that time she burned that slave master and freed all the Unsullied. Like, that was a pretty bold move. I liked that one, but, I'm not feeling a lot of confidence in Danny. I mean, that's not to say I didn't enjoy her feeding that guy to her dragon and then like quipping, being like, well, don't want to overfeed them. I mean, like, that's pretty cool. I'm not sure it's wise, you know, statesmanship, but it was pretty badass, I guess.
Yeah. So anyway, her incredible plan.
Yeah.
Is to reopen the fighting pits and marry the dude who is the head of that prominent family.
Right.
And what's his name again?
Hisdar Zolorak. Hisdar. And we've seen him, you know, he's been around since she got to Meereen, basically.
He's been around asking them to reopen the fighting pits for many episodes.
Well, not just that. Before that,
you know. No, I know. I'm being facetious.
Okay.
But yes.
But I liked this actually because at least it was Danny's decision. In the books, it's not her decision, this proposal. So, you know, she's sort of more of a pawn. And in this, at least it's her idea and her choice. You know, and as far as this is what's happening all over, right? Prominent families are marrying a prominent family. So a Targaryen is marrying a Zolorak in order to try to unify the device, you know, the divided city. Yeah.
What did you think of the way it went down in the show? I mean, other than like just the scene itself when she goes in and
I liked it when she was like, you're already on your knees. And I actually really like that guy playing Hisdar.
Yeah, so. he's great. And also, that is probably the biggest reversal that any character in the show has ever experienced. Meaning, he is in a jail cell about to get burned alive. Finds out not only is he going to survive, he gets to marry the Queen of Dragons. I mean, that is – he's got to be feeling pretty good about himself.
I hope so. I hope Hisdar is patting himself on the back. I don't really know what my read it was on that scene because basically all, you know, all the other heads of families when she's standing in front of the dragon are cowering and begging. And Hisdar is standing tall, you know, and saying Valar Morghulis. And she was like feeling his back. I don't have 100% beat on what was going on there in her mind. Like, is she thinking he's brave? I could see myself marrying him. Like, I didn't really understand what her takeaway was there. So
I think when she put her hand on his back, what she was doing was like indicating that he was going to be the next one that was going to be toasted.
Okay.
That was my, like, she puts her hand on his back and then like takes it away and is like, well, better not overfeed them.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
So that was my take on it. Probably the most interesting plotline this week happened at Winterfell. And this is with we check in with Pod and Brienne, and Brienne says, like, pass a message on to Sansa. They get a message to Sansa. I think we can safely assume that the woman who's passing the message on is passing Brienne's message on, yes?
Right. I think so, yeah.
That basically says, like, if you are in trouble, light a candle on the tower, right? Is that something like that?
Yeah, I think Lantern in the Broken Tower, which is sort of like a one if by land, two if by sea maneuver.
And that's the one where – that's the tower where Bran was pushed out of in the first episode, is that
right?
Correct?
Right, yes.
So anyway, then we get a scene with Ramsay and Miranda and some sex position going on here.
Yeah, yeah.
So the dynamic here is that Miranda is the kennel master's daughter. And Ramsay has been kind of involved with this woman since last season, I believe, right? Since season three, I think. Is she the one who, like, he's hunting down, like, this other person with?
Or? Yes.
Yeah, okay.
But I think that might have been season – like, I'm not sure when Miranda showed up. Miranda definitely showed up in that hunting scene. But there was another girl, the other two girls who were part of the whole Theon torture thing, and I don't think Miranda was one of them. Gotcha. I think the first time we saw her was in that hunting scene.
Gotcha. But even that hunting scene showed that she's like pretty psychotic, if I'm not.
Yeah. Like a traitor to her sex for sure. So
yeah. Yeah. So anyway, they are like sexually involved, and then Miranda gets jealous at the fact that Ramsay's going to marry Sansa and that Ramsay's attracted to Sansa. And we actually saw that, I think, last week, if I'm not mistaken, where Miranda kind of gave Ramsay this icy stare, right?
Or like 2 weeks ago when Sansa first got to Winterfell. Right, right. Miranda did not look pleased, yeah.
So then Ramsay, like Miranda says, okay, well, maybe I'm just going to get out of this relationship. Maybe I'm not getting enough out of this, Ramsay. Maybe I'm in this for more than just a good time. And Ramsay's like, no, you're not going to do anything, or else like I'm going to do bad things to you. And she's like, okay. And they seal their agreement by having violent sex. Classic Game of Thrones.
I do want to mention something. I don't want to body shame the quite beautiful actress who plays Miranda. But in an episode with a bunch of fat jokes about Fat Walda, I will say that I think that Miranda should have been shot from a different angle because her hip bone was jutting out in a really unsettling manner to me. Hmm. So, like, just if you want to watch that scene again, she's a beautiful woman.
Well, the point of fact, Joanna, I did watch that scene like 18 times.
The way her body is twisted, her hip bone is just like poking out in profile, you know, and you know, your body yourself. But that was distracting to me.
Well,
Ramsay's boat, on the other hand, not distracting. I feel like it enhanced the scene greatly and I enjoyed it. So.
Well, I think you and I just have like completely opposite reactions to that scene.
Who would have thought?
I have the inverse reaction. So
I don't really know what I mean. We'll get to that. You know, I guess we're going to talk about Miranda and Sansa next. But I feel like Miranda is a wild card in this scenario. I can't really tell what her end game is. I mean, her end game is to either punish Ramsay or have Ramsay to herself. But I can't tell what uniting Theon and Sansa does for her exactly. Like, I thought her endgame sending Sansa into that kennel was to mentally torture Sansa because she hates her.
No.
That makes sense to me. But no, because uniting her with Theon is some sort of helping her. And it's either helping her get vengeance on Ramsay or just helping her escape so she can have Ramsay to herself.
Interesting. No, my reaction is that is purely an act of revenge on Ramsay. Like, when Ramsay starts, I don't know, doing her in that scene, like, the camera lingers on her reaction shot. Like, you see her
face.
Oh,
yeah.
And she's not happy.
Oh, like, yeah. She's
not,
upset.
She's not into it, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like, she's clearly not happy with this arrangement. And so her showing Sansa Theon is her attempt at messing up the arrangement.
But then why wouldn't she just leave? I mean, my question is, does she want Theon for – does she want Ramsay for herself? Like, does she want to take – like, is this short-term revenge – or does Miranda have a long-term plan?
I think it's – like my interpretation was just this is her way of throwing a monkey wrench into the entire proceedings. Because
okay.
I think the theory is that if Sansa sees Theon, she's not going to want to marry Ramsay. Because I guess the – again, this is all assumption. But the theory is that once she sees Theon, she's going to realize that Ramsay is who has like done all these horrible things to Theon. And
well, Ramsay can say that he did it to defend, you know, her brothers. I mean, that's why Ramsay was sent to Winterfell in the first place under under the guise of saving Winterfell from Theon and the Ironborn, right? And I'm not sure that that's how it goes down the show, but like that's the thing is like it's this plausible deniability. I tortured Theon because he did this horrible thing to your brothers. Right?
Interesting. But yeah, I mean, firstly, it doesn't even play out that way, right? I mean, I think if my theory of what she was doing is correct, then she got exactly what she wanted.
Right. You know chaos I mean? Is not a pit, it's a ladder. And Miranda's going to climb out of it. But my question is, where is she going to climb?
Yeah, I mean, well, some people don't think that far ahead when they are spurned lovers.
It's possible.
I know when you are spurned, you are like incredibly calculating.
I am Littlefinger-esque when I am spurned.
But some people, they just have irrational reactions and they just do stuff.
Just want to watch the world burn.
They just, they just drive across, five states with a diaper or something. And they don't have a plan, Sometimes that's just the way sometimes that's just the way of love, is you just show your lover's betrothed, her brother-in-law-esque person who your lover has tortured horribly. Classic irrational lover spurned syndrome.
Yeah, it's basically the Westeros version of driving with a diaper, for sure. And before we move on from that, there was a down shot of Sansa looking up at the tower, which is an exact copy of a shot of Catelyn looking up at the tower when she was like sort of figuring out in season one where Bran fell. And then later in the dinner scene, which comes next or comes after Theon and Ramsay, we see Sansa for the first time back in the Winterfell style of clothing, because like ever since she left Winterfell, she dressed in the style of King's Landing, and then she went into like goth mode over at the Vale. But now that she's back home, she's dressing like her mom. And if you look at sort of some of Catelyn's clothes and then look at what Sansa's wearing in that scene, it's pretty striking, which is just some nice bit of, costumery telling the story.
I was actually quite tense during that scene when Miranda's like, "Can I touch her clothes?"
I thought, girl.
Is she going to do something? What's she going to happen?
But I like how Sansa was not buying it,
Yeah, that was the only thing that I really thought was pretty dumb this episode, was when Miranda says, "Hey, just go down this like dark hallway with all these violent dogs. Nothing's going to go wrong." This is like the scene in a horror film where, to quote Drew Barrymore, the woman is running up the stairs of her house instead of going out the front door.
True.
It just felt like, why? Like, and if something bad happened to Sansa, I was probably not going to forgive this show, to be honest with you. If she had just like, "Oh, I'm just going to wander into this cage without thinking what's going on," and then something horrible happened, I'd be like, okay, that was super dumb. But it was slightly less dumb than I thought it would be. So it ended up being fine. And it leads to this aha moment, or this gasp-inducing moment when she finds Theon, and
Alfie Allen once again is just amazing, I think.
Yeah, he says very little, but he, at the same time as saying very little, he says a lot.
He's twitching volumes.
He's twitching volumes. So I had a thought, by the way, when Bran is pushed out of the tower, like, is that event? If that had never happened, we still would have gotten all the events of Game of Thrones, probably, right? Like, that wasn't the inciting – like, the big event is Ned Stark deciding to go to King's Landing as the King's Hand.
Or Lysa Arryn murdering Jon Arryn,
right.
Like, killing the original Hand of the King. I mean, it's hard. You can keep going back and back.
Right. But the Bran thing is, like, just incidental, right? There's nothing really
there. No, because it sets Catelyn off against the Lannisters.
That's true, because the person like comes in to try and kill Bran.
Right.
Right. And then Catelyn's like, "Well, I gotta go chase him." And then that like indirectly leads to like the Red Wedding, I guess. Right?
I mean, basically everything. All roads lead to the Red Wedding.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So then there is a very awkward dinner scene, I guess, with the Boltons as well as Sansa and Walda Frey.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading a Vulture interview with the guy who plays Roose Bolton, and basically anytime Roose is having a meal in this show, something horrible is happening, right, pretty much, which I thought was an amusing observation.
I remember that Jaime Brienne scene, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That didn't go super well either. So anyway, Ramsay is essentially like tormenting Sansa throughout this entire scene, right?
Yeah, he's messing with Sansa, he's messing with Theon. And then at the end of it, Roose like checkmates him, which is great.
Yeah. So I guess my only question about this scene is Theon didn't actually kill her brothers.
Right, and both Ramsay and Roose know that.
Right. So I just thought it was interesting that Theon is willing to confess. Like, theoretically, Ramsay has brainwashed him so that he has, like, forgotten his old life. But Theon is willing to remember the fiction and not the reality. Or perhaps, like, maybe the brainwashing is so effective that he's just doing anything that Ramsay tells him to, right?
I think that's where we see Alfie Allen at play there, because I feel like we see Theon struggling to come to the surface, and then, you know, Reek wins over Theon. Right. But yeah, Ramsay is messing, like, it's a test of Theon, right? Are you going to apologize for this thing you and I both know you didn't do? And with the added bonus of tormenting Sansa while he's at it. There was a promo video for this episode that cut together the audio from – it was an official promo thing, but it cut together the audio from the Miranda Ramsay scene where he says, you're not going to bore me, or you know what happens to people who bore me. They cut together that audio with this dinner scene of him looking at Sansa. And so a bunch of people freaked out because they thought that was him saying – it was a very misleading promo, is my point.
Yeah. Instead, Ramsay was just psychologically torturing
Sansa. Oh, yeah, yeah.
He wasn't physically threatening her.
He wasn't out and out threatening her.
Yeah, he was just, like, tormenting her endlessly.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
So, totally different story.
Yeah.
Roose comes in at the end and says, like, hey, like you said, checkmates him by saying, hey, you know, my wife is pregnant. I'm going to have a son, and Ramsay feels like his position is threatened. And then Roose has a scene that's so heartwarming. It compares to last week's scene with Stannis and daughter. What'd you say?
Really quickly, I want to talk just really briefly about Sansa in this dinner scene, because someone was talking to me about how they wish Sansa was a little bit more duplicitous, that she's not doing a good enough job pretending to be happy to be there. And maybe she doesn't need to be. And not everyone can be Margaery, right? Not everyone can, like, lie their face off and just smile and pretend to be happy. But I wish Sansa were being a bit more, guarded with how pissed off she obviously is to be there.
Really, I think she's doing fine, to be honest. I think, like, she's doing as well as any of us could, put it that way.
Well, I mean, it's been a little inconsistent with Sansa. I was rewatching, and I'll get to why, but I was rewatching the Blackwater episode earlier today, and Sansa does this masterful stuff with Joffrey where she's like, oh, my lord, my brother was always in the thick of the fighting. Like, I know that you will be too, because my brother's just a traitor and you're so brave, to Joffrey, just playing him and manipulating him. So we've seen Sansa do it. I know she's been through a lot. But we saw her last season, lie to the council about Littlefinger. Like, we've seen her do it. She's in a traumatic position. I'm very pissed forever at Littlefinger for leaving her there without any friends. But I think Sansa could handle it. And I think she could be a little bit better than she's doing.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a good point. I think trying to think of, like, why she might not be handling it as well. Maybe, I guess from my perspective, there's just so much emotion there in Winterfell, do you know? I know we're, like, we're reading into, like, second level emotions here into these characters, but I guess it just must be, like, a really disorienting situation for her, because in the old one, I guess she, I don't know. I don't have a satisfactory explanation.
No, I mean, you're right. She's in Winterfell. Her family's dead, but she's in her old home.
Right, exactly.
Deeply traumatic. I agree.
It's different. I guess it's different when it's, like, a traumatic situation. When you're supposed to marry a psychopath, like, in a strange land, versus when you're supposed to marry a psychopath in your home. You know?
In your home where your brothers were reportedly roasted alive.
Right. Yeah. So I guess I feel like that kind of adds to the level of emotion. I think, she hasn't been like and also I think she had more time to adapt to her situation at the Blackwater. Like, by that time, she'd been at King's Landing for a whole season or a couple seasons, right? And she just got to Winterfell, like, last episode or two episodes.
Okay. So what I would like to see then is in future Sansa be more manipulative. And it's possible that that's what we are seeing in this scene, because at the end she's smiling, not just because I think Ramsay is upset to find out that there's, a spare heir brewing, but, like, to see a weakness that she could possibly manipulate.
Mm, yeah. All right. So then, yeah, we get Ramsay's origin story, which is, like I said, just as heartwarming. It's like the Stannis and his daughter origin story if both of them were psychopaths. Like that is what this one is like.
Or it's like Bizarro, Ned, and John, right?
Right, exactly.
Like, yeah, this is how this bastard was born. Yeah, it was a beautiful thing. Beautiful, beautiful memories to cherish.
Indeed. Indeed. Any other thoughts on Winterfell before we move on?
No, just that, you know, the Boltons are preparing for war, I guess.
Yeah, they are ready for what Stannis is going to throw their way. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, what a lovely origin story. You know what I mean? Like, just the level of detail there about okay. So let's realistically though, you know, what was Roose said some line that kind of showed how ruthless he is. You know, like where he was saying, like he almost like killed the woman or something like that. You know what I'm referring to?
I mean, he almost killed Ramsay too. Right. Yeah.
Right. I guess it's easy to forget how, like, when you compare Roose and Ramsay, like Roose seems like the reasonable one. You know what I mean? It's easy to forget that he, you know, murdered the Starks in brutal fashion and, you know, did a lot of back dealing and, you know, horrible things to get to where he is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Ramsay didn't get his psychopath behavior from his poor dead mother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, on that note, let's talk about domain names, Joanna.
Let's do it. What a great lead in.
I know. That is an amazing segue, guys. let's say you have an origin story you want to tell. You have a great idea. You have something heartwarming that you want to share with the world, right? And you want to do it at an online web address. That's going to facilitate it in a really easy and quick way. We'd recommend hover.com. Go to hover.com/egg. That's hover.com/egg to get 10% off your first purchase. Hover is the best way to manage and buy domain names in less than 5 minutes. You can find the domain name you want and get it up and running. And also, if you've ever registered a domain name anywhere else, you know that some companies make it a really unpleasant experience. They make it really complicated to just buy what you need. They try to upsell you on stuff you don't need. Hover doesn't believe in heavy-handed upselling. Instead of charging you for something that should just be there, Hover includes everything you need with your domain. You get smart control panel, Whois privacy, and Hover even offers a free valet transfer service, so you can skip the hassle of trying to move your domains over there from what they're currently registered, because some registrars love to make it difficult to do that. Joanna, let me ask you this question. Like, how many – do you have any registered domain names?
I do.
How many do you have?
Three.
And may I ask what they are? Or can you name one of them that you feel safe sharing?
Yeah, that would be stationagents.com.
There you go. And that's your TV podcast, right?
Yeah, it is.
And yeah, like I have probably.
Oh my god! Do you think I have hidden pornographic domain names?
That's well, like... it just what's funny is like it's actually really funny because when you ask people like what their domain, it's almost like asking them like to see what's in their garbage. You know what I mean? It's just like there's stuff there that you might not want people to know about because like when I have probably 30 domain names.
Wow.
That's probably what I have.
Okay.
And I've used a bunch of different registrars, and I will say Hover makes it the easiest to do it.
Excellent.
To buy and transfer a domain name. But yeah, it's kind of like whenever you think of an idea, you just want to grab that domain name because like what happens if later on you finally think to yourself, oh, I'm going to act on this, and then the domain name is gone. Then it's too late. There's nothing – you have no recourse at that point except buying it perhaps at a very – like a much higher price. So whenever you have an idea, you want to snap that domain name up immediately. And yeah, there's definitely some domain ideas that I'm not proud of, you know. But fortunately, Hover offers free Whois privacy, so people don't need to know who, you know, owns what domain names that you own. They don't need to be able to look up your address, which they'll have to do. They have the ability to do with other domain name registrars. So with Hover.com.
Do you have one that's like Ollie is king.com, Ollie for the Iron Throne.com?
You're acting as though like I don't have both and many more similar okay. to those, right? Okay. But fortunately, if I did have those domain names, I'd have Who Is Privacy on every domain name that would support it for free from Hover.com. So if you'd want to support Cast of Kings this season and you want to get something out of it as well, go to Hover.com/egg, get 10% off your first purchase. I really appreciate Hover being one of our two sponsors this season of Cast of Kings. We also got to thank all the people that donated to the podcast via Kickstarter and made this podcast reality. Joanna, you want to start us off with these awesome donors today?
I will. I want to thank John Simpson, Etienne Gagné, Chris Sheehan, Yusuf Alnafjan, Adrian Seal, Anna Witasik, Greg Miller, Steve and Heather Yacero, and Adam Wells, Megan Morgan, Paul, I am Wheat King, Wilson, Bill McCarthy, and Sam Kessler. This next name that Dave is going to say is a character from Night Court. Take it away, Dave.
Bull Shannon. Matt Hizzy. That cannot be real. Emily Christensen, Craig Smith, Clifton Fells, Michael Hoops Gonzalez, Carlos Mayer, D.L. Jones, Goran. Or actually, no.
Joran.
Joran.
Yeah.
Joran with an umlaut. Raymond Terry, Mike Enos, and Jocelyn Hanna, as well as Jack Way. Thank you guys so much for your contributions. Wow. I don't think that was as rough as last week, but it was pretty rough.
Anna Witoczyk? That's my second go at that name.
Okay, nice.
Sorry about that.
Good job. Thank you guys for contributing to the Kickstarter.
Thank
and again,
you.
Thanks to Hover at hover.com/egg for supporting us this season. A couple more plot lines to discuss. So let's go to the wall. We got a scene where Sam and Maester Aemon discuss Dany.
Yeah.
We also see like some more Gilly action. Like Gilly and Sam kind of talking about libraries. Right?
Yeah.
Some exhilarating library talk. But yes, Sam and Maester Aemon discuss Dany and then John and Aemon talk about like what John is going to do. So what do you make of all these scenes with Maester Aemon?
I liked the – first of all, I love the guy who plays Maester Aemon so much. And I think his speech to John – well, okay, yeah. I will say this, that his speech to John – about Kill the Boy is so important in the books because you hear about it actually after John has heard it. And so what you do is you see John do all this stuff, and every time he has to make a hard decision, he says to himself, kill the boy, as if like this is his new mantra, kill the boy, kill the boy. This is what Maester Aemon told me to do. It's more poignant for John in the book because he actually is a boy, you know, and here this is, he's a grown ass man,
right.
But but still.
It does rob it a little bit of its poignancy. I will say that it did come a little bit out of nowhere for me. Like when I was watching it, I wasn't thinking, oh, John. Like he's already been elected Lord Commander, you know?
Yeah.
And honestly, my first reaction, honest to God, not joking, was, why does Maester Aemon want to kill Ollie? That was serious. No joke at all. Like that is serious. Like what is wrong? Like, you know, has Maester Aemon been listening to Joanna? You know, that was my reaction. Like, what?
Why? Maester Aemon and I chat on the rig. We were, like, really close.
Yeah.
We send ravens back and forth all the time. So he's team kill Ollie for sure. Kill that boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I will say it seemed like it came out of nowhere for me. Like, I did not think that was a particularly formative moment.
Well, I mean, he was sort of giving the same pep talk that Miss Sandy gave Dany, which also didn't work for you, which
yes.
is like, you know, you're in charge. They're working really hard this season, I feel like, to draw the parallel between John and Dany. And he's basically saying, you know, you're in charge. Do what you think is right. Just man up. And it doesn't matter. Like, don't worry that half of them are going to hate you. They hate you already. Do what you think is right. This is what you should do. I did like, you know, some. I think sometimes people forget that Master Aemon's a Targaryen, so I did kind of like all that connection to Daenerys and remembering that he's this weird satellite Targaryen sort of moldering at the wall.
What is his relationship to Dany again?
It's like great uncle, I think, or something like that.
All right. It is kind of cool. That was quite a revelation a couple seasons ago when that happened. So anyway, Jon's plan is to let the wildlings through the wall so they can settle south of the wall. And then hopefully later on when they need to take King's Landing, right? I guess.
I think it was more defend the wall against the White Walkers.
I see.
Like basically, if the wildlings are on this side of the wall, then the Night's Watch and the wildlings are a united front against the White Walkers who are marching on the wall for five seasons now or however long they've been doing it.
We have not seen them for quite some time.
We get to see them about once a season. One season I think we saw them a couple times. But I think it was kind of a mistake. That was it, like season three ending or season two, where you see them basically like charging on the wall, and then I guess they got bored and left or whatever. But right,
yeah, it's just it's a situation of I think the show trying to juggle too many elements, you know, because when you try to have so many cool elements, some of them are going to go by the wayside. There's just too many. We have this whole White Walker situation, and then
I think it's winter is coming eventually, but they have to keep showing us the White Walker so that we remember that they exist. And they can't show them having like tea and crumpets many, many miles north of the wall, though they did show them having like a baby shower many, many miles north of the wall. But, you know, they want to show them continually engaging with people so that you remember that they're very, very scary.
I guess. I feel like it's just been a while. Like, it's, you know, like, it's just hard to feel. We're supposed to feel this, like, menace, I feel, right? This ominous, like, dread that these walkers are going to be here soon. And I just don't feel that at all.
We saw them turn a baby into, like, an ice zombie, though. So that was pretty scary. That was last season. So.
Yeah. I'm just not feeling it, I guess. But, okay, so then what's the thing with, like, it sounded like Stannis wanted John to join him, right? To take Winterfell?
Yeah, that's what he wants.
So is that part of John's plan at this point?
John's immediate plan is to go round up the wildlings
right. That
were following Mance Rayder.
And then he may or may not join Stannis.
Yeah, right? He told Stannis he'd bring back his boats.
Right. which, by the way, I had a difficult time believing that Stannis would lend John the boats.
Like, I feel like he wouldn't lend John all of his boats. Like, he lent him a fleet. Like, give John two boats.
Like, one or two boats.
A boat or two, not the whole fleet.
So Tormund and John have a conversation, which I thought was great, actually, when Tormund has that moment. He says, well, that's easy to say to someone in chains.
Right.
And then John takes off a chain, like, okay.
Bam.
Okay, yeah. I guess I respect you now.
I feel like I don't know if I didn't notice it as much last season because I hadn't seen the movie Force Majeure yet, but the guy who plays Tormund had like his Swedish accent was very thick, I thought, in that scene, which I love. I love it. So.
Interesting, yeah. Force Majeure, great film. So Tormund basically agrees with Jon, except he says, you have to come with me. That's his only condition.
Right.
And so then John, Brandon's gift, what is this, Jonah Robinson? You've written it in the show notes.
Oh, that's the space on the other side of the wall that he plans to give to the wildlings. They refer to it as the gift in the episode, but it's just basically land that he would let the wildlings settle on if they came south of the wall.
We should also clear up, by the way, this is like correction from last episode. You were right that John did sign that letter for the Boltons, right?
Right, yeah.
He did not get interrupted by Melisandre. That was just my perception of the scene, I think. So anyway, what happens? John addresses the Night's Watch. People aren't happy with it.
Right.
But apparently the plan is happening, right?
Yeah.
So
What do you think of Stannis' sort of grammar Nazi moment?
I thought it was amazing.
I thought it was the best thing ever. It was like my favorite, well, second favorite part of the episode, but...
It came out of nowhere, because it's not, I don't think Stannis has been a grammar stickler in the past.
Well, this is what I wanted to tell you, that this is actually a callback to season two. There's an episode, it's episode four, season two, Stannis and Davos are sailing to the Blackwater.
I vaguely remember this, yes.
Yeah, and... you know, and Stannis is like, you don't mind that I chopped off your fingers or something like that? And Davos goes, oh, it's four less fingernails to clean. And Stannis says fewer. And so it's like his thing. It's his thing, which I love. I love everything they're doing with Stannis. So
it's great. It's great. And yeah. And that is, you know, the using less when fewer is correct. That really sort of grinds my gears as well.
Oh, so, yeah. It's a pet peeve of mine as well. But totally. And Stephen Delane, right, is the actor. His facial expression when he says it, too, fewer, and then, like, never mind. So good.
Really,
so good.
Really great. Okay, so this is something that a random thing that I wanted to point out was, a couple years ago, I was chastised, very rightfully so, by a listener when I was talking about, how the show uses... regular metrics, right?
Right.
Ways of measuring time and distance that we are familiar with. And if this is not Earth, why would they be using things like years or days, right? Which are Earth concepts, right? And then a listener, I don't remember who, pointed out how smug I sounded when I pointed these things out. But really, it would be really distracting. Like, the show, would you prefer that the show, you know, used random ass words to define time? Like, that would be more distracting than if they use Earth time. You know, if they're like, hey, it was 15 centons ago that
you mean parsecs,
your mom died or something, just is it's weird. It would be weirder to use invented terms. I think parsec is a real term, actually.
Is it?
I believe so, yeah.
Oh, okay. I mean, I know it's distance, not time, but I thought it was a Star Wars thing. It's a real thing?
I believe it's a real thing. I've heard that before. Yeah.
Okay.
I was rightfully schooled, and it no longer bothers me when people use days and years. But I will tell you what does bother me.
Oh, no.
Is people in British accents using the imperial system. Right? Don't they use the metric system in the UK? That's my understanding.
Yes.
So it's just weird. The reason that they gave everyone in the show British accents or variants thereof is they wanted it to sound exotic and medieval. It's just weird to me to hear people talking about miles, which they do a lot in the show.
Should be saying kilometers.
Yeah, kilometers. would kilometers be more distracting? You know, it's just weird. The whole thing is just weird. Anyway, okay. That was a long walk to point out a very small nit.
But you picked it.
I felt it necessary to do so.
All right.
So there it is. And I can't take it back now. I'm not going to edit that out. So, what else? So Stannis decides hey, we're marching on Winterfell.
Well, I did want to point out the scene after Sam and Gilly talk about the books and they talk about Old Town and where the maesters are trained and blah, blah, blah. Stannis comes in. I loved this Stannis moment too with Sam. And he talks about his father, Randall Tarly, and he talks about, you know, sort of gives him this grudging respect rather than, you know, talking bad about his father or whatever. And, you know, and then he tells Sam to keep reading, which is great. But yeah, Sam's on the hunt to figure out how to defeat the White Walkers, and obsidian / dragonglass is the best answer they have so far. So worth noting.
Stannis is taking his daughter with him and his wife with him, right? Which Davos
the
advises.
Worst idea ever. Why is he doing that? Brings their wife and daughter? Well, he did make a good point that
which
everyone
is like,
at the
would
wall
you rather leave them with rapists and murderers?
Yeah, that was a good point. Yeah, that's true.
Right? I think that's a pretty solid point.
Yeah.
So then we have Stannis going up against Roose, and I guess at this point, right, we're meant to root for Stannis, right? I feel like that's what the show is trying to guide us to do.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that way?
Yes. I mean, I think you would root for anyone versus Roose, right? Well, maybe not the Lannisters. Yeah, but Roose Bolton's pretty awful. So it's, you know, even if they hadn't done all the character rehab on Stannis that they did this season, I think we still, by default, be Team Stannis against Roose. So
So then the only other plot line this episode
is the best one.
So Jorah and Tyrion.
Yes.
And they sail through Valyria.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Which is what is Valyria's relationship to the characters again?
So it's the, you know, ancestral home of the Targaryens.
That's right. Yep.
And the Doom of Valyria, which they talk about in this episode, basically Valyria was this magical city. The comparison that people make who are fans of the book is to Atlantis, right? So it's this magical city where they had advanced learning, advanced everything.
Interesting. That is fascinating that Atlantis, because my initial thought when watching this scene was the Roman Empire, which reached like incredible heights and then just collapsed, like, you know, in the spectrum of time, it collapsed like overnight.
Right. Know? Well, sort of. Like Atlantis literally overnight, or Pompeii, because what happened in the Doom of Valyria is it's this sort of unexplainable incident where there were earthquakes and fire from the earth, and fire from the earth that reached so high it scorched the dragons out of the sky and all this sort of stuff. So that's why I think more mythical Atlantis or actual Pompeii rather than Rome, which collapsed, but over time – and natural causes, not this like weird supernatural thing that happened. But that's why Valyrian steel is so like their methods were so advanced. You don't get Valyrian steel anymore. That's why it's so rare. Mm-hmm. But you know, their metallurgy skill was so great that's why Valyrian steel is this amazing thing that it is. So yeah, old Valyria, the Doom of Valyria. And that's sort of what, when Jorah and Tyrion are sailing through it, which looked amazing, by the way, I thought, they start to recite this poem, right, which is not in the books. It's referenced in the books, but it was written for the show. And in the books, it's called – I think it's a song. And it's called – I believe it's called The Dance of Dragons, which is performed at Joffrey's wedding. But they actually made it up for the show, and I thought they did an amazing job. And yes. Peter Dinklage and Ian Glen are so amazing. So, you know, write them more poetry to read together is my show note, basically.
And for me, it was like a shocking moment when this dude just jumps into the water straight up from nowhere.
Yes.
Really,
because you were distracted by the dragon. As were Jorah and Tyrion. It was done so well. It's a really great chapter in the book, and so I'm so glad that they included it. But in the book, it's an argument. Like, people on the boat are fighting, and in this, they used a dragon to distract them, so that when the stone men jumped down, it was a surprise. I do want to say this, you know, before we get to the stone men, I do want to talk about Tyrion's reaction to the dragon, because I just think it's really important to take in, you know, what a game changer this is for Tyrion to see that dragon. And it doesn't happen in the books, but there is a passage from a chapter nearby. Tyrion's remembering, thinking about seeing a dragon. And there's a passage that says, once a man has seen a dragon in flight, let him stay at home and tend his garden in content. For this wide world has no greater wonder. Tyrion, he is dying to see a dragon, and he sees one. And then all of a sudden this like horrible thing happens to break the moment. But that just – that one moment of Drogon flying over Valyria, so amazing to me. So,
yeah, I think in the Inside the Episode section of the HBO, they talk a little bit about it too, and how this whole situation kind of reminds him of a time that feels like long past, like a time when Valyria used to dominate the Westeros, and when dragons existed and were part of life, you know? So.
Yeah, and I really liked what Weiss and Benioff said in that section about Jorah, too, because it's a reminder of Dany, and Drogon is so much bigger than when last he saw him.
Right.
That it's just a reminder of how long he's been away from her, what has changed, how he can't wait to get back to her, all of that. So, yeah, good moment.
Yeah. So then these stone men come, and they're like, Jorah's like, don't let them touch you, which I thought was great, because then it establishes what the stakes are. Like,
right.
You don't even know what's going to happen. You just know bad things.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they pull the big fight scene, really intense. They pull Tyrion, and somehow, like, Jorah gets Tyrion to safety. Not sure how that happens, because they look like they're really far away from where they were. But whatever. I can accept it. It's beautiful. They're on this beautiful beach.
Yeah. In a golden hour shot.
We find out that Jorah has been infected. So the Stone Men, like, what is their deal? Like, I get that they are, like, they have grayscale to the nth degree, right?
Right.
But why do they want to, like, kill these dudes or do them harm? Is it that grayscale drives you insane as well, or what?
Yeah, I mean, it calcifies your insides, so you just sort of, like, become a beast. And Gilly, you know, they did a good job setting this up in the show, I think, because a couple episodes ago, right. Gilly was talking to Shireen about what happened to her sisters who got grayscale, and how they locked them in the shed, and how they basically turned into animals. And it's not just the disease. I think it's also the isolation. The real-world corollary is leprosy. So, you know, these people who are infected with grayscale, because it's infectious, because it's a disease that people don't understand, they're ostracized. And so they're sent to Valyria to sort of, you know, slump around and be outcasts. So that itself will also mess with your mind, right?
Yeah.
And then I think in the books also, they're hungry because they're sent provisions on a ship. Like, a ship is sent upriver to them, but it's infrequent, you know, so they're outcasts. They're going mad. They're starving. It's not like they're going to eat Jorah and Tyrion, but I just think they're, yeah, driven mad by that experience.
I see. Well, I didn't get any of that stuff, but yeah.
Well, there you go.
It did, yeah, you're right. The show does set it up, and it's definitely an effective scene because the guys are pretty terrifying. So.
And Stannis said to Shireen last week, you know, when he was talking to her about her grayscale, he said, you know, they said they should send you away to live among the Stone Men in Valyria, but,
nice.
You know, you're my daughter. I'm not going to do that to you, et cetera, et cetera. So.
Yeah, I guess, are they just primarily men? Is grayscale like a primarily male?
No. Stone men, I mean, like, there's never mentioned any stone women.
Shouldn't they just be called stone people? I guess.
Stone folk.
Yeah, the stone folk.
Yeah.
The stoners. Or
but, something. You know, yeah, Shireen has grayscale. Gilly's sister's got grayscale. It affects women as well.
Yeah. And then we find out that Jorah has grayscale at the end.
I'm so upset.
Yeah. Well, that's not going to end well for him, most likely.
I don't know. I mean, honestly, I don't know what they're going to do because this is not in the books. But
oh, wow.
I mean, it's like a different character in the books. But, like, I knew it was going to happen. Like, I knew – when I knew that they were going to do Stone Men.
Yeah, you knew one of the characters had to be infected.
I knew Tyrion was going to go overboard, that Jorah was going to save him, and then he was going to get grayscale in the process. And then my heart is still broken, and I don't know what's going to happen to him. You know I love Jorah. I've loved him from the start. I'm really upset.
I just want to point out, by the way, that the way that Tyrion was rescued and that the way he was depicted in the show I thought was incredibly effective. Because they did not film what would have been probably a very expensive and extensive rescue sequence, right?
And
it just, like, goes to black. And I thought we were going to have, like, another Sopranos moment.
Yeah.
Where it just goes to black, and then, like, 30 seconds later, the credits fade up, you know, and then you don't even know what happens to any of them.
And that's what happens in the books, is that the chapter ends with Tyrion being dragged into the depths by a stone man,
right.
And you don't find out until, like, 4 or 5 chapters later what happened to him.
Yeah.
That kind of nasty cliffhanger is something that George R. R. Martin loves to do. So I was waiting as well. I was like, is this episode going to end on a shitty cliffhanger? Is Tyrion
but
being
dragged
it
was great
water?
because it gives you that expectation and then it subverts it, right? Because then you find out what happens and it's like by Tyrion waking up and you see it from his POV. I thought that was brilliant. So.
So
this episode had a lot of some ups and downs for me. You know, like, there's some stuff that I really love, like that sequence, and there's stuff that I was like, eh. Like the whole Missandei stuff, I was like, eh. Overall, what'd you think of this episode?
I mean, the Valyria Stoneman Drogon stuff obliterates any misgivings I might have.
All right.
Also, a lot of great Stannis stuff. And, you know, I'm really intrigued by this Sansa Winterfell business. So, yeah, I'm excited.
All right. Well, I think that's going to wrap us up for today. Where can you find more of our episodes? You can do that at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. Email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. In terms of where you can find us this week, find me at SIFF.net, where you can buy tickets for my film, The Primary Instinct, world premiering on May 29th at the Seattle International Film Festival. That's SIFF.net. Joanna, how about you?
You can find me on vanityfair.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
Thanks for listening to A Cast of Kings. We'll see you guys next week.
I want to thank John Simpson, Etienne Gagné, Chris Sheehan, Youssef Anjaf.
You're just like, nope, that's wrong. I'm going to start over again.
Oh my God, what do you think that is?
It looks like Alnaf John.
Okay, thank you. Please edit that out. Thank you.